Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Gerald Smith interviews Tubby Smith later in the hour about his coming appearance at Rupp Arena, and we'll hear how the Transamerica Bike Trail winds across Kentucky. First, though, our kids, our jobs, and what's needed to make it all work. A shortage of affordable daycare and of daycare workers means that some parents who want to return to jobs can't. This lack of childcare has not so much been caused by the pandemic as exposed by it. Steve Magray, CEO of Kentucky Child Care Advocates, joins us from Louisville. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
And Steve, as I mentioned, a characteristic of this pandemic has been the way that it has exposed or revealed already existing conditions that, for one reason or another, had been going largely unnoticed. Does this apply to child care?
Oh, absolutely. And it's been a little ironic in terms of the various groups I've interacted with. I've actually brought that up early on, going back to the first part of the pandemic taking place, and saying that as tough as this is and as hard as it's going to be, the one thing that's going to play out is exposing the importance of what we do and how we do it and what impact we have on families, on the children, but frankly, on economics and keeping the state working and keeping people being able to go to their jobs. Very early on in 2020, it was clear and it was really understood by, if you will, Chamber of Commerce people, certainly business owners, small business, corporations, you name it. They understood when you look at what the funding priorities are out of the federal government to get America back and going, our funding support is unreal. It would not have been predicted, certainly going into the pandemic. So it speaks to the significance and importance and the role of child care centers that are regulated and certified. And frankly, the other type centers that are more home-based, away from what you would consider traditional child care centers, all of us play an important role in terms of the engine of the United States of America and keeping it and moving forward. So it's hard to say this, but that has been one positive that would have never happened without, you know, the pandemic exposing it.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's say I'm a young parent or a parent of a child who I want to place in child care, and I'm shopping around. How can we know if a child care provider is regulated, and what else should we be looking for?
Well, starting place is to see their credentials, make sure, you know, this is a certified center and that it's being regulated by the state. And then all those things are postings. It would be no different than a restaurant, you know, in terms of its A rating or B rating or that it is allowed to be open. All these things are posted if they're regulated child care centers. Maybe if you think about it, check off questions that should be asked when a parent or parents are visiting, that would be a starting point.
Well, Steve, if I were to ask you to imagine a future without regulated child care, what does that look like?
Well, I will use the qualifications for what's called the Child Care Assistance Program, which is all about people who are working, but the nature of their pay is such that without assistance, they could not afford child care. In those kind of cases, and this is a partial answer to your question, if they couldn't afford it, then you with me try to fill in the blank. They're going to work. Who is watching that child? I mean, we're really talking about the basis of being able to spring forward into first, second, third grade, and so on. If they know their colors, phonics, all these types of things that can be captured in a child care center, coupled with one of the things that's really significant, structure and also socializing. So when they move through the child care center, when they come through it, they're really in a position to be tested out in a very high score. And we've been able to document that very well over the last several years. not so much being able to do this during the pandemic, which, you know, we're in our second year. But prior to that, we were, you know, running around 75-77% preparation. It's easy for the ones that are coming in prepared to see their academic abilities improve. Not so easy for the ones in terms of their track when they come in and they're not doing well and they don't have this good start. And so it would be a significant concern. I'll give you some numbers. At the end of 2019, right when the pandemic was to start, we had 28,500 or so children that were participating in what's titled the Child Care Assistance Program. So their parents met that qualification as related to their income was low enough that they could get assistance. Today, I think we're sitting on about 18,000, maybe a little less. And it has come up in the last 4 months. I think it was at lowest point was around 13,500, 14,000. But it's not a rebound that's complete. So we're talking 23 months ago, there were 28,000. So the question is, what happened to these 10,000 children? So it is extremely significant in terms of even the fine-tuning aspects of it. But when you see this blob just drop and it's totally shifted, yeah, it really is concerning. How are we going to get from where we're at right now back to where we need to be? And honestly, we're under the leadership of Sarah Vanover and the governor and his people, the cabinet, where we were in 2019. We were in a good place. We really had a lot of momentum and we were participating in a very good way with child care centers around the state.
Well, you mentioned earlier the Chamber of Commerce, which has a keen interest in child care. Business has a major stake in child care, especially in these times of labor shortages, due in part to unaffordable or inaccessible child care. What would you like to see the private sector do to help remedy this situation?
The biggest concern we have coming out of this is that the pay, the increases that are taking place on these other job sectors is so significant, it's going to be real difficult to figure out how childcare can keep up with it. Let me explain it this way, and this is pretty close to being accurate, but I'd say, generally speaking, the average startup pay, at least, is right around $10 when we came into the pandemic. It ironically had been lower than that, and we had got it up to around $10 an hour going into the pandemic. We understand what the ramifications are and how we're going to have to get out of this pandemic and see America get back to work and get our state back to work. And the pay that people are going to be able to get, it probably starts around $15, probably will end up being more around $17 or $18 an hour. And then even some of these larger employers will be able to pay $20 an hour. And so what we're left with is, you know, who is really going to want to take on a job for $12.50, $13.50 an hour? So, you know, there certainly is government kind of bringing everyone together here, almost like a summit. If it's Chamber of Commerce or corporate leaders or businesses to choose to say, yeah, we want to participate in this. We really need to have these child care centers up and running and available because that's not only the right thing to do, but we have to have them. Now that there's attention given to it, I would hope that we could see Chamber of Commerce leadership or agencies that are so well known, if it's the ones we work with or the Pritchard Committee or the Metro United Ways around, you know, that we could bring people to the table that are government leaders and business leaders, and really stay tuned in as to how we can move forward, making this a better situation. Frankly, I think whole sectors that were out there got caught a little off guard in understanding just how critical childcare is to make sure that they can produce. It's not just about profits, but it's about that their businesses are doing as well as they can do versus not being able to do that. So I think we all have the same goal in mind here, but we do need their attention and support. And frankly, it's been very positive. It looks like we have their attention. And you know, I think they are going to be assisting as we move forward. But even that's shifting landscape and moving forward. If one thinks in terms of the inflationary side of what's happened and playing out here, and just a whole lot of money being spent that hasn't figured out how are these coffers going to get refilled. I mean, it really looks like we have inflationary times.
Yes, it does. And as we said early in the interview, that this pandemic has revealed so much about our society that we had just not realized or had kind of become inured to. It's been really revealing. Steve Magray is Chief Executive Officer of Kentucky Child Care Advocates, and we thank you so much for your time, Steve.
I appreciate it, Tom, and thank you for providing me this opportunity. You're providing a real service in taking this issue on the way your station has chose to, and we thank you for that.
All right. Thank you. An adoption support program in the College of Social Work at the University of Kentucky has won national recognition for its contributions to caregivers. Joining us with details about this program is Dr. Jay Miller, Dean of the College of Social Work at the University of Kentucky. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Miller.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this program, Adoption Support for Kentucky Virtual Interaction Program, has received a 2021 Adoption Excellence Award from the Department of Health and Human Services. It recognizes key contributions to increasing the number of children from foster care who are adopted or placed in other permanent homes. So we're talking about the ultimate goal in adoption here, stabilization, when being reunited with a birth family is not possible, and being permanently settled with a new family is possible, and then possible to move on with life. The program was launched back in 2018, as I understand it. What inspired its creation?
Well, so the program came about as a way to recognize that we needed to provide support for foster and adoptive parents in a much more creative way. You know, we kind of recognized that the landscape around adoption and foster care was changing, and that, you know, foster parents and adoptive parents were struggling in some aspects to get the support that they needed. And so we saw this program as a way to innovatively provide, create, and assess the support in ways that would ultimately stabilize foster and adoptive placements.
How does it work to support and make a difference to caregivers?
Well, I think ultimately, you know, being a foster adoptive parent can be a very isolating thing. I myself grew up in out-of-home care, and I was taken in as an older teenager by an aunt and uncle. I'd never met them, and we were related. But, you know, you can kind of understand that bringing young people into your home who have experienced some kind of maltreatment can be challenging, and then navigating the support systems can be equally so. And so what we seek to do through Ask VIP are really two things. Number one, we want to create and foster a collective and supportive network for foster and adoptive parents in a way that really normalizes the challenges that they're facing, so that we kind of tear down the concept of the isolation and really get everyone to understand that there's a lot of commonality in the challenges that these adoptive parents face, and that if they are in this space and fostered in a supportive way, they can be supportive to one another. And then number two, we want to identify ways that we can more adeptly train and prepare foster and adoptive parents for situations that they're going to face. So through ASK, we're able to identify, you know, topics and subjects that are important to foster and adoptive parents, and we can proactively develop initiatives, you know, training and otherwise, to help them be more prepared to deal with those challenges.
Well, I would think that if you are contemplating becoming an adoptive parent, or if you are one and you're not aware of this program, that it would be quite reassuring to hear that this kind of support is available.
Absolutely. And I think for many folks, it can make all of the difference, knowing that there are communities and supports available to you can really factor into how you think about or how you engage in an adoptive process. And what we often find is that, you know, ASK is a mechanism for, you know, foster parents who haven't yet adopted to come in and get some supports and understand and learn more about the process. And it really helps, you know, them that, you know, they might be on the edge about making a decision to adopt, or they might have some apprehension, et cetera. Or they're assessing their own family situation to see if they're appropriate for seeking to adopt a child. And so being involved in ASK allows them to really explore in a critical and supportive way all those questions, because ultimately, you know, we don't want folks put in a space where they adopt and may not be prepared to provide the care. And then we also understand that sometimes adoptions don't go the way that we plan them. And so we want to be there. Ultimately, we don't want disruptions, and we want to stabilize placements, and we want to support not only the young people, but the caregivers, in ensuring that they have whatever it is that they need to do the important task that we're asking them to do, which is care for our foster and adoptive kids.
When the COVID-19 pandemic descended on us, there was a lot of scrambling going on in many quarters to adapt and to try to continue. What happened in your area?
Well, so here is the very interesting thing about ASK VIP is it's something that we had started and launched prior to COVID. And so the interesting thing is, I think when we got the award, which, you know, we were very humbled to receive, a lot of folks thought that ASK had come about as a product or response to the pandemic. And in actuality, we were doing it before COVID. And what it allowed us to do is to continue to provide that support at a time when caregivers really needed it. Through our centers and labs apparatus, we'd done research and where we looked at, you know, the impact of COVID on parental stress and caregiving stress. And of course, as expected, it was very high. But because we had the infrastructure and because we had built out ASK in a way that tore down the geographic boundaries and allowed folks to access support in a way that was timely and efficient for them, it really gave us an opportunity to provide the support at a time when it was most needed. So we were very fortunate in the sense that we had started to travel down this path far from COVID, and quite frankly, it helped us assuage or mitigate some of the impact to the caregivers because we had done so.
Well, on a slightly different subject, Dr. Miller, but I'm pretty sure this is in your wheelhouse, we've heard concerns about burnout among caseworkers with caseloads far exceeding the recommended annual limit. What are you hearing?
You know, there's always, particularly among public child welfare workers, they are tasked with doing an impossible job. And the pandemic has only made it more difficult to do that job. And so, yes, you know, we are at a time where, you know, a lot of data and research suggests that these workers are experiencing stress and burnout in ways that they haven't previously. And it's really, you know, connected to a broader systemic aspect of how we think about the work that they do. So there are resource limitations. There aren't as many places to make referrals for families. There are all these things that really compound the job that of protecting and serving children and families throughout Kentucky. So, of course, they're under an inordinate amount of stress, not only as a race to their job, but of course, the personal stress of their own situations and navigating COVID. So, it's certainly on the rise, not only in Kentucky, but across the country in terms of the burnout and stress that these workers are experiencing.
Is there demand for newly minted social workers? And is this burnout situation discouraging, or are you seeing more people step up to the profession?
Well, I think it's really, we're at a turning point where we kind of have to reframe the way that we think about child welfare in general, but specifically, you know, social workers who practice in that space. You know, historically, particularly with in state government context, you would see workers come in and they would work for 20 or 25 years and they would retire. And now the workforce looks and wants to operate in a different way. So, yes, we do see, you know, in the College of Social Work, we are really focused on educating and preparing folks to go out and to do that work. We actively recruit folks to address these limitations in the workforce. But it's important that once they graduate and get into the work, that we continue to support them. So we have a number of initiatives through our self-care lab that's really designed to help them deal with some of the stress and burnout of the job. So it's certainly concerning because, you know, child welfare workers, they do a service that we cannot place a value on. The protection of our children and the service of our families is an invaluable thing. And we want to ensure that they have the resources to do that. But what we must understand is that it's going to take all of us. It's going to take a systemic response. So everything from state government officials to community resources to our colleges and universities to our private citizens, all of us have a role to play in the protection of children. And so it's really important that we all recognize that we are part of this thing we call the child welfare system, and that we respond accordingly, and that we do everything we can to support, you know, the workers to do the job we're asking them to do.
That's Dr. Jay Miller, Dean of the College of Social Work at the University of Kentucky. Thank you, Dr. Miller.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Coming up after the break, former Wildcats coach Tubby Smith.
You know, I always taught our players, and I teach our players about being respectful of others. And one thing my dad taught me, said, but the only thing you have is your name. It's the only thing you have. Mm-hmm. And that little dash between when you were born and when you died, what did you do? You know, people don't really care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Plus, the Kentucky staycation and keeping it all in the family.
One of the things we're seeing in hospitality and tourism is multi-generational tourism.
And the Kentucky hospitality found along the Transamerica bike trail.
There's a real vulnerability to being on a bicycle. And when I've talked with people, both who ride the trail and also people in communities along the trail, there's just hospitality at every turn.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Wendy Barnett with the Undermain Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. Take a trip this holiday season just across the Ohio River to the Cincinnati Art Museum for three very different stellar exhibitions. American Painting, The 80s Revisited, is an extensive survey of this very important decade in 20th century art. Carol Walker, Cut to the Quick, features 80 works by the famed contemporary artist who often depicts uncomfortable, historically based subjects. A third exhibition, Simply Brilliant. Artist Jewelers of the 1960s and 1970s contains over 100 astounding pieces of jewelry from one of the most important private collections in the world. More information is available at cincinnatiartmuseum.org. For the best in writing about the arts and culture of Kentucky and beyond, go to Undermain Magazine online at undermain.art. I'm Wendy Barnett with another Undermain Arts Minute for WEKU's Eastern Standard. And now, back to Tom Martin.
If you're like me, this pandemic has really gotten in the way of some important travel plans during the past couple of years. Most important among them, vacations. Dana Bush chairs the Department of Applied Human Sciences here at EKU, and Dr. Bush was the developer of the university's online Global Hospitality and Travel Program. She recently talked about it with Cynthia Reeser, discussing tourism during and after the pandemic.
So, Dr. Bush, the new buzzword in tourism because of the pandemic is domestic tourism. Tell us what that means.
So, domestic tourism is pretty simple. It's just traveling close to home. And, you know, I think traditionally when we think about vacation or holidays or travel, we think that it's got to be, you know, some great distance. We've got to travel thousands of miles and potentially get on a plane. But because of the pandemic, many people have discovered domestic tourism and just, you know, driving a couple of hundred miles, maybe to a city, a couple of counties over, and enjoying what they have to offer.
And, you know, Kentucky's especially well-placed for this. What are some of the domestic tourism opportunities that are here in Kentucky?
Oh, it certainly is. You know, Kentucky is known for its beautiful natural areas. So we're seeing a lot more Kentuckians take advantage of that through the state park system. The lakes, you know, Kentucky is well known for its lakes and boating. We have lots of festivals. I was telling a friend of mine the other day when they were asking something about Kentucky, and I said, you know, Kentucky is one of those states that I think every county has a festival. So we're seeing a lot of growth in festivals, a lot of visitation at local festivals. And let's not forget about the Bourbon Trail. Some of that has been closed down because of the pandemic, but people have been doing really unique things to bring people into their stores, be it virtually or in person. So Kentucky's got so many wonderful things to offer, from the north to the south to the east to the west.
So if a person is thinking about taking advantage of these growing opportunities, what might they do to prepare to help grow a business or start a business in domestic tourism in Kentucky?
Yeah, so I think there's several things that could prepare a person for this industry. Of course, number one, you really need to have a love of working with people, you know, making people happy, being very hospitable. So that's kind of a good foundation to be a, you know, someone who loves social interaction. Then education is really important. You know, understanding the business side of things is important. You know, as you mentioned, we've just started a program in global hospitality and tourism at EKU. And what we hope to provide these students to prepare them for these jobs is a way to really plan what they want their business to look like and to make that a personal connection, because hospitality is just that, right? It's making someone feel valued and really enjoying their experience. So like we have a concentration in gastronomic tourism. Those students are going to be planning tours for all different types of people and, you know, making sure that they understand their needs. So that's just some of the basics of being successful in the business.
What could a community do that's new or different that might help them attract tourism?
There's so many things that we can do on social media and getting acquainted with social media, and it changes daily, doesn't it, Cynthia?
Yes.
I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing how fast technology changes, but we've really got to stay on the cusp of that and making sure that we're attracting all consumers of tourism. And what I mean by that is one of the things we're seeing in hospitality and tourism is multi-generational tourism. And that's when families are traveling together. You know, I have traveled personally with my mother, with my daughter, and with my grandmother. So four generations have traveled together. And we span, oh goodness, I can't do the math that quick in my head, but, you know, 60 plus years. So, you know, my 96-year-old grandmother has certain needs that my 22-year-old daughter does not have. But the one need they have in common is to have fun together, to enjoy the experience together, wherever that may be. But we've got to make sure that we're providing the needs for that individual traveler.
Another thing I've noticed with a lot of the tours that you mentioned, like the culinary tours, is to find a specific niche. In other words, what types of food and meals might apply to one group of people might not apply to another. And that's sort of like multi-generational, but it's also something a little different, maybe.
Yeah, because we all have different palates, right? And I think that is, you know, going back to your question about what can communities do to attract tourism, is it seems like every community has some specialties. So like Lawrenceburg has the Burgoo Festival, you know, and that's definitely a specific food. It has, you know, you have to really like vegetables and meat and all the different, some of it have game, you know. So people are going to travel to those areas because of what they like, you know, their palate. You'll see different culinary tours for those that are on a gluten-free diet, but they really want to enjoy the different gluten-free options. So that could be one type of specialty culinary tours. And of course, you know, wine tours, the bourbon trail, all of those things are really big businesses. However, obviously, you've got to enjoy and drink wine to want to go on a wine tour. And the same thing with bourbon. So we are seeing such a big differentiation in culinary tours where people are really getting into that niche, as you said, and people are gravitating toward what their tastes are, what their palate is, and things that they want to try too, that they may have never tried before. I have some friends coming in from several different states in the month of December, and we had a Zoom call the other day, and I said, so what would you all like to do when you're here? What would you, you know, and they immediately started talking about food. And they said, well, you know, since we're coming to the South, I want to try collard greens. I want to try this. I want to try that. You know, things that they don't have in Long Beach, California, that they've heard about and they really want to try. And they want to try it here in Kentucky. So I've got to find me a good collard green recipe.
I've been talking to Dr. Dana Bush, who's the chair of EKU's Department of Applied Human Sciences. And I'm thrilled that you joined us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about one of my favorite topics, travel.
Me too. Thank you.
Thanks.
The Transamerica Bike Trail has been routing riders through long stretches of rural America for 45 years, stretches that run through Kentucky. So we wondered what these two-wheel travelers from all around the world are finding when they pedal across the Commonwealth. Kim Cobersmith writes about it on thedailyyonder.com and joins us from Berea. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Kim.
Thanks, Tom.
So your article is headlined, Flagship Cross-Country Bike Trail Follows Rural Route, Makes a Lasting Impact. And we're curious about that impact. But first, if you would tell us about the Transamerica Bike Trail.
Yeah, it's America's flagship cross-country bicycle route. And the eastern end is on the Atlantic in Virginia, and it goes all the way across and meets the Pacific in Oregon. As you said, it's a rural route. The biggest city is Eugene, Oregon, which has about 172,000 people. It traverses nine states and goes for about 4,218 miles. The origins of it were back in 1976 when two couples, the Siples and the Burdens, became bicycle fanatics, and they hitchhiked to Anchorage and embarked on an adventurous Alaska to Patagonia ride that they dubbed the Hemis Tour. They were featured in a National Geographic article, and as they began to build up enthusiasm in the nation for two-wheel transportation, they dreamed up this epic way to celebrate the nation's bicentennial. And they called it the Bike Centennial. And according to Greg Seipel, it's still the biggest bicycling event in U.S. history. There were 4,000 cyclists from 50 states and 329 foreign countries that summer, and they rode more than 7 million miles.
Wow. So that we can get our bearings, give us a sense of how the trail passes through Kentucky. It's pretty much end-to-end for the state, correct?
Yes. It starts in Elkhorn City in the east, goes through Hindman and McKee, gets to Berea, which is a common stopover, or in bike lingo is a zero-mile day. It then goes through Harrodsburg, Springfield, Utica, and crosses the Ohio River just north of Marion in Crittenden County. There's also an optional Mammoth Cave loop that riders can take to see, you know, our famous national park here.
Okay, and we're going to circle back to Berea and a particular host there in just a minute. But before we get there, is it known how many bikers ride the trail each year? And can you tell us a little bit about the demographics? I think you mentioned riders come from all over the world.
Mm-hmm. The trail is now coordinated and promoted by Adventure Cycling Association, which is a nonprofit headquartered in Missoula, Montana. They grew out of the group that coordinated the bike centennial back in 1976. Now they have 30 other routes also that they coordinate. And there is no typical rider on the route. For example, there's a Transamerica bike race every year. So for example, the first place rider this summer is named Craig Pauly, and he finished in 18 days. Also this summer, there's the first cross-continent bicycle ride by a blind athlete, and she rode on much of the Trans Am, and her name's Shawn Cheshire. So the riders have been a couple on a tandem bike who are celebrating retirement, or volunteers who are working across the country at Habitat for Humanity houses, or Europeans that come over for their American adventure.
What can the riders expect to find in the towns that they pass through? Has a network of hosts pretty much taken shape over the years?
Yeah, I talked with two different small towns in other parts of the country that have really seized on bicycle tourism as an economic opportunity for them. One of those is Sterling, Kansas, which has about 2,500 people, and it's not actually on the Trans Am, but it's just off it by a mile or two. But they invite travelers to their town with signage along the trail, and they've also made a conscientious effort to provide the services that bicycle tourists need. They have 7 food establishments, which is really important because the cyclist can burn 7,000 calories a day.
Wow.
So, yeah. So they have restaurants, groceries. That even includes mini marts that would be accessible to the bikers. They also have a city park with a campground that has specific bike sites. Wi-Fi and a shower house are available there, as well as there's a bike repair station.
Well, tell us about Maya Todd.
Mm-hmm.
Maya is a trail host in Berea.
There's a really interesting network across the country of both formal and informal ways for what they call trail angels and volunteers. So Maya Todd of Berea, she first hosted a friend of her daughter's in 2014 and since has hosted over 100 cyclists. They've been from India, Germany, South Korea, all over the world. One of the formal ways that people find hosts is an online connection called warmshowers.org, where hosts can offer, like, the minimum is a camping spot and an access to a hot shower. The service is free, but it's termed as being reciprocal. So in Maya's case, some of her guests have cooked her meals, done chores around her house, given her small gifts. And then she also has a neat collection of thank you cards from some of her guests. When there's a tradition, when you finish the trail, you take a picture of yourself and your bike right in the ocean, and then you can send that as a thank you note to people who helped you along the way.
You talk with a frequent trail rider, trail name Kilgore, said that he thought the physicality of the trail would be more difficult than it turns out to be. I would have thought that too. What does he mean? Aren't there some pretty steep hills, for example?
There are, and I was really surprised by that as well. But Zach Kilgore, I talked with him after he had come about 860 miles when he stopped in Berea. He was having a 0-mile day. He was riding about 40-mile days, which actually is not very fast. He was not considered an athlete before he started. And really, the trail has been his conditioning. But he said that actually the mental part of the ride has been more challenging than the physical part of the ride.
That's interesting. The trail is designed to pass through rural areas for practical reasons, but because of that, it goes through an America that most people don't see. And you note that that experience can change perceptions of rural people. How has it done that?
There's a real vulnerability to being on a bicycle. And when I've talked with people both who ride the trail and also people in communities along the trail, there's just hospitality at every turn. So it could be something as simple as putting a cooler of water by a mailbox that says for cyclists that people can pick up. Or when you see a cyclist who's broken down outside of your house, you invite them in for dinner. Seipel told me about a woman who had a reputation. She was known as the Cookie Lady. She lived in Virginia, and she started seeing the cyclists riding by her house. So she asked what was going on, and they told her about the trail. So first she put out a garden hose for the cyclists to refill their water bottles. Then she started heating up her oven and baked cookies for them. Turned out she owned the empty house next to hers, so she began hosting people in the house and filled it with trail postcards and memorabilia. And so she just became a real touch point on the trail for people.
So interesting that all that's going on in the middle of everything else that we have happening in the United States of America. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and I just think those real human encounters go a long way to shifting people's perceptions and stereotypes of people. When you get to know them on a personal level, it just kind of makes that all shift.
Yep, it makes all the difference. Kim Coppersmith, based in Berea, a contributor to the Daily Yonder, and you can find articles by Kim and other contributors writing about rural America online at the Daily Yonder, one word, thedailyyonder.com. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you. I want to ride my
UK historian and Lexington pastor Gerald Smith hosts the Eastern Standard Series on Racial Justice and Equality. And Dr. Smith has a special guest this week, one who will be making an appearance at Rupp Arena later in the month.
Orlando Tubby Smith, the head men's basketball coach at High Point University, is his alma mater. Coach Smith has had a very distinguished career at several universities, which have included universities of Tulsa, Georgia, Kentucky, Minnesota, Texas Tech, and Memphis. He coached the University of Kentucky men's basketball team to the 1998 NCAA championship. While in Lexington, he and his wife Donna established the Tubby Smith Foundation to assist underprivileged children. Coach Smith has been named National Coach of the Year 3 times and was honored with the John R. Wooden Legends Coaching Award in 2016. He has made 20 postseason appearances as a head coach, including 9 Sweet 16 and 4 Elite 8 trips. He clearly stands among the most honored, recognizable, and leading coaches in the NCAA. Tubby and his wife Donna are the proud parents of 3 sons and a daughter. Coach, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Smith.
There has been a great deal of excitement about your return to Rupp Arena for this matchup with the Kentucky Wildcats on December the 31st. What are your thoughts about this homecoming?
Well, first of all, thank you for the great introduction, just the way we wrote it up. But it's wonderful to be coming back to Lexington. We don't make it back there that often. You know, obviously, I haven't been able to keep a job. Obviously, we haven't worked at 12 or 13 different jobs. But I'm really fortunate to still be doing what I love doing. But it's going to be great to be back to see friends and family and fans of the Big Blue Nation. That's that's the longest time I've spent anywhere other than my 17 years of growing up in Southern Maryland as a kid. We're in Lexington, Kentucky, both as an assistant coach with Rick Pitino in 86 to 89, then coming back there as a head coach in 97, 98. So it's a lot of people to see, and just want to make sure that if anyone doesn't get a ticket, it's not my fault, okay?
Understandable. Listen, a lot has taken place in college sports, not only in college sports, but also in the nation in recent years. So first of all, what kind of impact has COVID-19 had on your basketball program?
Well, it's been tough for everyone. Certainly we've lost a lot of great people, friends, family members because of this pandemic and this COVID-19. So it in athletics, you know, it's really taking its toll on these young student athletes. Many of them, first we had one kid missed 40 some days, 42 days. Another young man missed 38 days because he was contact traced, had COVID, contact traced again. We had to move 4 of our games. You know, it had a major impact on the season last year, not just for us, but around the country. But I think we're regrouping and recovering as well as we can right now. The psychological strain and the stress that these young people are under has been, you can see it in their faces, but they're starting to come around.
What kind of team do you think you're going to have this year?
That's a great question. I'm hoping that we'll have a team that can compete with the Wildcats, but I'm in a situation here where we're, you know, playing Kentucky as a what we call a guarantee game, and obviously Kentucky was looking for another game when they called me. we're relatively young. We actually have 3 starters back, And we have a very talented player in John Michael Wright, who's was a leading scorer, second leading scorer in the Big South last year. So we've been able to surround him with some good people. So we'll be much more competitive this year.
Another question about college sports in the nation in these recent years, especially this year. What are your thoughts on the name, image, and likeness policy?
Well, it's interesting that young people, obviously their value and their worth sometimes is predicated on how many likes they get on their social media. But, you know, I think it would bring some realization to them of their value. And man, schools like Kentucky, you know, you're going to have some student athletes that might be able to benefit from their name, image, and likeness. But here at High Point, there are a few players that have made a few bucks because they, you know, they wore a T-shirt or went to a restaurant and might be able to get a free meal. But in the end, they know they're going to have to report that to the IRS. And I want to make sure they pay their taxes so my Social Security is intact. But I'm glad that they're doing it because it's going to be beneficial to all of us older folks anyway. But I'm happy for them. It's something that was needed. And I think, you know, student-athletes have been receiving their Pell Grant, their cost of attendance was something that was instituted quite a few years ago where you could pay kids the actual cost of going to school, which at places like Kentucky is probably $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 on top of receiving your Pell Grant or any other benefit. So it's, you know, young people today, student athletes are able to benefit, and I'm happy for them.
This past year, we've also witnessed a great deal along the social justice movement, especially the participation of not only college athletes, but also pro athletes. You have any comment about that?
Well, yeah, you know, there have been people that have been that, you know, we stand on the shoulder of these pioneers. Like I had a chance to see Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and meet with him and listen to him speak about, you know, way back when Jim Brown and guys like Bill Russell were at the forefront of leadership. And we've had people in the coaching profession that we lost John Thompson this year, the black coach from Georgetown who was a leading voice, who was very instrumental in helping us get the Black Coaches Association started, which is now the Black Coaches United. I was just looking for a book. We Will Win the Day, The Civil Rights Movement, The Black Athlete, and The Quest for Equality. I'm looking forward to reading that book that just kind of talks about, you know, the impact that athletes have had in leading this fight for our civil rights, you know, against racism. And so I'm happy to say that, you know, I'm a coach, I'm an African-American coach, and I've felt like, you know, I always taught our players, and I teach our players about being respectful of others. And one thing my dad taught me, said, but the only thing you have is your name. It's the only thing you have.
Mm-hmm.
And that little dash between when you were born and when you died, what did you do? You know, and people don't really care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's where I think we really have to change. I mean, it's hard to change hearts. You're a minister and a doctor. It's hard to do. So in our society today, with all the distractions, and I think, you know, things that have made an impact with Black Lives Matter movement. But I'm humbled by the leadership that we're getting from our young African-American generation,
mm-hmm.
and I'm pleased by it.
Tubby, as you know, you know that I am the co-editor of a book series that is being published by the University Press of Kentucky on race and sports in America. And I want to thank you for agreeing to serve on our editorial board. Why did you agree to serve on this board? And you know, here you might want to say something about your affiliation with the Black Coaches United organization.
Well, obviously, when you call and mention what you were doing, we certainly want to be part of that conversation about our culture, about Black in sports, and hopefully we've race in sports in America, and how we've and the impact that our people before us had. And so we think that it's critical for young people, not just African Americans, but people in general, that they really don't have a real appreciation for the changes that athletics has really inspired throughout the years. And I always said that that's about as fair playing ground or court as it is in sports. Because you're, you know, you being judged on your, you know, your ability to get certain things done. And I was one that, and when C.M. Newton hired me at Kentucky to be the first black coach, one of the things I told him and people ask you all those questions. I said, well, I want to be judged on the content of my character and not on the color of my skin, which is what we all want and need. So I'm just excited to be a part of your editorial advisory board and whatever we can do to promote and service and inform and educate people. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, Coach. Also, you might want to say something about the Black Coaches United. You've been a very strong leader with that particular organization.
Well, we have been. There are people that are engaged, like Shaka Smart at Marquette, Leonard Hamilton, who used to coach at Kentucky as assistant coach, was a longtime assistant under Joe B. Hall, recruited some great players there, you know, like Sam Bowie and that went on to win national championship in 78. So I just we've been a part of it since 86 when John Thompson, John Chaney, and a few of the other – there were only a few black coaches, head coaches in Division I level. And they were guys that – and we were trying to get jobs, head coaching jobs, assistant coaches were. So it was developed – you know, Rudy Washington was the president at the time, and we've now changed our name to Black Coaches United. And so we're encouraging as many minority coaches, assistant coaches to get involved because it's – you know, it's made a difference in my life. When this organization first started, people like myself, Leonard Hamilton, and others were able to benefit from a lot of guys like George Raveling, John Thompson, John Chaney, and Nolan Richardson, and the success they were having at the Division I level. So we encourage everybody to get involved.
What kind of legacy do you hope to leave behind, Coach?
Well, as I said before, I just hope people know that Coach Tubby Smith was a guy that cared and built relationships and left programs in better shape than he found them everywhere he went. So I'm grateful for this opportunity to be coming back to Kentucky. I'm grateful to still be coaching at my alma mater at High Point University. So it's a lot of exciting things happening in my life, so we're looking forward to the future.
All right. Thank you,
Coach.
It's
just getting started for me.
I know that's right. Thank you. Today we've interviewed Coach Orlando Tubby Smith, head men's basketball coach at High Point University in North Carolina. Thank you, Coach. Have a good day.
Well, thank you.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Wendy Barnett, producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgerald-Dean, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, and on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.